Live from London, you're with Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk TNT.
And good morning and welcome to the Sonia Poulton Show on today's News Talk TNT. Yes, we are explosive wherever you are viewing us, YouTube, Rumble, X, Instagram, or right here on TNT. It's wonderful to have you with us. Do not go anywhere. And you know what? If you have to walk the dog, if you have to take the kids to school, take us on the app. We will travel with you. So let me tell you what's coming up on today's show. We'll get a reaction after Donald Trump's opening day in court in charges of paying, allegedly rather, of paying hush money to porn star Stormy Daniels. We'll also ask former UKIP leader Henry Bolton whether he thinks the government's Rwanda plan will ever get off the ground. And political commentator Chloe Dobbs is here with us, and she will be telling us why Keir Starmer's support of Angela Rayner could damage him politically, if he's not already damaged enough, that is. Now, today in Parliament, another reading of the Tobacco and Vapes Bill. The long title is A Bill to Make Provision About the Supply of Tobacco, Vapes and Other Products, including provision prohibiting the sale of tobacco to people born on or after 1st of January 2009 and to enable product requirements to be imposed in connection with tobacco, vapes and other products. Well, this is an interesting bill to me because the fact is vaping has long taken over, way taken over from tobacco and smoking, as many young people were cynically encouraged to take up smoking that way. Introduced almost 20 years ago now, can you believe it? Vapes were marketed in ways that frankly appalled me. They were viewed as the healthy alternative to traditional smoking, and the eye-catching designs and sweet-smelling vapors attracted the attentions of young people. All of this despite it being illegal to sell them to under 18s. The fact is there is a significant demographic of 11 to 18-year-olds who are now addicted to vaping. Yes, and it's only now that the government is finally making decent provisions to protect these young people. The fact is, many researchers like myself knew they were a danger from the start. They were put onto the market and sold as a lie with little to no long-term research. The ingredients in e-cigarettes, for those who are unfamiliar, is formaldehyde, petrol. Both of these ingredients in part explain why many e-cigarettes have exploded. And despite the lack of research, by the way, the leading cancer research charity, Cancer Research UK, promoted them. I was absolutely furious in my film, The Business of Cancer. I absolutely tear into Crook for doing so, because even me, not a doctor, not a scientist, but I was able to research and see what was the problem with e-cigarettes when apparently a leading cancer charity was not. Shame, shame on them. Many are complicit, including advertising authorities and the UK government. 8 years ago, I argued in a TV debate about not allowing people to vape indoors. We had yet to find out about long-term impact. Then Joan Collins was on the show and tried to make out that they weren't really a problem, no more so than, say, aspirin, I think she suggested. Well, sorry, Joan, these last few years have proven you completely wrong. Vaping was a ticking time bomb which enabled people to become addicted to smoking and young people to become a whole new set of customers. They thought vaping was wonderful, far removed from the filthy, dirty cigarette habit of yore. This was fashionable and trendy. It was 1950s again. Cigarette smoking had been reborn to a new generation after the old way had become old fashioned. So no, smoking didn't go away. They just fashioned it into a lab product rather than a production line. So we are asking today that about the question of smoking, and that is, if the smoking ban is passed in the UK, what does that mean for civil liberties? And you can get in touch with us. You can call us. Here are the numbers.
Thanks for listening to us. Now we want to listen to you. Our lines are open from the US and Canada. Call 1-888-201-6425. From the UK, call 033-0024-1026. And from Australia and New Zealand, call 1-800-670-310. Free speech is alive and well on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And I am delighted to be joined by Gemma Cooper with the UK News headlines. Good morning to you, Gemma.
Good morning. Well, one of them is the smoking, the tobacco and vaping smoking ban bill, which gets its first full reading in the House of Commons today. And interestingly, Rishi Sunak faces quite a big, significant Tory rebellion against this bill, some calling it profoundly unconservative and civil liberties, which is really interesting when you think about the effects of the last 4 years, about how desperate they were for us to put stuff in our bodies. Now they seem to say, oh, no, it's a matter of free choice. So I think we'll come back to that one in just a minute. There is a lot to talk about there. Also in the UK this morning, unemployment is a big headline. It's on the rise. Nearly 5% of the working age adults are out of work or economically inactive, rather, or claiming benefits. And you mentioned the Rwanda bill there. I mean, I'm getting so bored of this story. It's still the same story. Yesterday, the House of Commons rejected the House of Lords' proposed changes. It's now gone back to the House of Lords today, where it will get further consideration. Having said that, they still expect this bill to be passed by the end of the week. Let's see what happens with this one. It is a big election issue. We do have to keep mentioning it. And also yesterday, of course, we found out that they're not just considering Rwanda. If this is successful, people could be sent to Costa Rica, Armenia, the Ivory Coast. The list seems to be endless, anywhere except the UK. But it is this smoking bill, which gets its first full debate in the House of Commons today, which I think is worthy of further analysis.
Well, let's look into it. First of all, clean hands. I had a tobacco nicotine habit addiction for 27 years now, 10 years free of it. And it is a horrendous addiction. Gemma, talk to us.
Well, it is. It is all addictions. If you're under the grip of something that controls you and you don't control it, no matter what it is, food, work, sex, status, there are many addictions in this world. It's not very nice if you're not in control of it. Having said that, there are significant amounts of Tory MPs today because this is a free vote on the first debate today. So it means there's no whip. There's no chief whip telling you how to vote on this. It's a free vote. And some significant Tory MPs, former prime ministers, Liz Truss and Boris Johnson, have already come out and said they don't support this bill at all, the tobacco and vapes bill. Liz Truss has called it profoundly unconservative. And Boris Johnson is, well, in typical Johnson style, he's called it nuts. But the bill itself would make it an offence, as you rightly say, to sell any tobacco products, just tobacco products, to anybody born after the 1st of January 2009. And it was one of Sunak's three key policies that he announced at the last Conservative Party conference. So obviously this is part of an electioneering campaign. So he's very keen to have it go through. But there are expected to be significant opposition to this in the first debate later. But Labour have said already that they're going to back it. So it still will be passed through its first reading in the Commons, because obviously what we have now is a uniparty. We don't have an opposition party, and they are backing it. It doesn't criminalise smoking. This is, people are confused. They're thinking, oh, if you're born after the 1st of January 2009 and you're caught smoking, you're breaking this new law. Well, you're not, because that's actually impossible. And it all goes back to this debate about what you put in your body. What you put in your body is free choice. People often think that if you take drugs, you're breaking the law. You're actually not. If you're taking recreational drugs that are illegal, class A, class B, class C, you don't break the law. You only break the law with drugs if you possess, supply, import, or make, produce drugs. Putting them in your body is not a criminal offence. So this bill will mean if you're caught selling tobacco products, you will then fall foul of the law. But of course, it's wide open to abuse. Anybody born before the 1st of January 2009 will still be able to buy products. It'll be that old age thing of, kids outside the off licenses said, oh, mister, can you go in and buy some cans of beer? All of that kind of thing. And also many Tory MPs are saying this will lead to a black market. Simple as that, will lead to a black market. If you can't buy them legally, you'll go and buy them illegally. Looking at the revenue for this, tobacco tax brings in 10 billion a year. The NHS is saying it's costing them 17 billion a year in the health problems created by tobacco and 80,000 deaths. One of the leading preventable causes of death in the UK is smoking. Well, of course, New Zealand tried to introduce exactly the same law, Jacinda Ardern. Anyone born after the 1st of January 2009, same as us, lockstep. They wanted to bring it in. She passed it. And lo and behold, the new government that came in to replace her said, no, we're scrapping that. We're not having that. It's everybody's free will to decide what they put in their body. I've never smoked. I think it's absolutely disgusting. But if you want to smoke, your choice, your choice. It'll be interesting to see where this bill does go today with its first reading in the Commons and how many Tory MPs come out against it.
I mean, I actually do agree with you. I think that we need to have that freedom. That is about our own civil liberties. My objection is just the way that vapes were just so cynically marketed and targeted at young people. I found that particularly abhorrent, especially with like no long-term data to accompany it, and heavily pushed, obviously, and now has become a £1 billion market in its own right. So, no, I agree with you. I think people should be allowed to. And also, isn't it interesting, though, but suddenly our bodies, our choice, when And I think you mentioned this, over the last 4 years, we've almost been told that our body belongs to the state, right? That our body is the responsibility of somebody else, that however you treat your body, that is going to have repercussions for the person next to you. How interesting that this is all turned around now, Gemma. But also, I don't entirely trust MPs on this issue, because what I'd really like to know is how many MPs have interests in tobacco products, because I'm sure there will be some. In the same way, when they were voting for the Health and Social Care Bill, it turned out that over 300 Lords and MPs had interests in private healthcare companies. So there is often some issue that is going on in the background here. How do you think this first reading is going to go? Any idea?
Well, because it's a free vote, you know, it's kind of an opportunity for some MPs who might be disgruntled with Rishi, you know, you fell out with him over something else, to vote against this. Because it's a free vote, you don't have the chief whip telling you what to do. So it's an opportunity to exercise some kind of, you know, of your own personal rebellion, if you like. But I think what's interesting is this, you know, suddenly this complete reversal on you know, your body is sovereign, what you put in your body is your choice. Whereas it has been the exact opposite, and it still is. I mean, only yesterday, people are still being told you can get your COVID spring booster here in the UK. They're still trying to flog that one and get people to inject themselves with God knows what, despite the obvious evidence of excess death. But with smoking, which literally does affect everybody around you, you know, if you're puffing away on a fag, you've got no choice whether to breathe that air. You're breathing it in. No, that's absolutely fine. So again, the gaslighting, the mixed messages about health and the human body that come out of the UK government when it suits them is very interesting. And I do think as well that there's enough of a, not a smoking lobby, but plenty of people still do smoke. And I think that will raise eyebrows amongst people who still think, well, it is a choice. But of course, if you're born before the 1st of January 2009, you've got no issue. It's funny how this arbitrary date was adopted by New Zealand and the UK. It looks like lockstep, doesn't it? Maybe it was just another experiment to see if they could force people to put or not put something in their body. Maybe that was a kind of more of a kind of experiment. Let's see if we can get away with it. I don't know. I'll have a look at the vote later. I'll see if I can see what MPs voted how. And maybe we'll have a little update in the morning. But Labour are going to back it. So it's going to go through its first reading anyway. But I find it hilarious. You know, oh, your body is sovereign. You know, it's up to you. Hello, could we have that message for the last 4 years, please? It would have been quite nice, because it's true. What you put in your body is your choice.
Absolutely. Hope, love and peace, as our ancestors who fought for our freedom must be turning in their graves at the world today. And so say all of us. Gemma, we will see you in the next hour and we'll be right back.
TNT's Alex Zaharoff-Royd.
They need to expand the number of places and countries that can make ARM-powered processors. And Intel has actually made chips designed with ARM designs for years. This deal will give Intel's foundries, two of which are being built in the US at a cost of $20 billion, more chips to make. Now, TSMC has received $6.6 billion from the Biden administration towards its much-delayed 3 and 4 nanometer chip foundries in Arizona. So while we went from a drought of chips during the pandemic, the second half of this decade should see even more chips being manufactured than ever before, which the world will need, considering the AI boom currently underway will need ever more computing power to satisfy the ever-growing demand.
Talking Tech with Alex Zaharoff-Royd on today's News Talk, TNT.
I was such a young age, everything changed. My name is Chloe. When I was 13, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. When I found out, I just didn't know how to react. I felt like everything was just kind of closing in on me. It just became a routine, dad's doing chemo. I'd come home from school, wait for mum to finish work, and we'd go straight to the hospital, spend a few hours there, just draw. It was hard to navigate going to school, hundreds of kids, and I was the only one with a dying dad. He was diagnosed in March, and then he died in October. Towards the end, I heard about Canteen. It kind of felt nice to know that they had other people like me. They understood what I was going through and we didn't even have to chat about cancer. In 2020, I became a youth ambassador so I can help others the way they helped me. I've done so many things since I was 13. I've graduated high school, university, gotten my license, made a move across the country. Life now is just a whole lot more fun. Please give a gift today to support more young people like me experiencing cancer.
Our next steps to space.
This time we go back to the moon to learn to live, to work, to invent, to create.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Now, yesterday, Donald Trump's trial for alleged payment of hush money got underway, but more than half of the New Yorkers asked to serve as jurors in the case against the former president said they could not be impartial, raising fears, of course, about whether or not he'll receive a fair trial in the state. Now, joining me now with his thoughts on the matter and what these criminal proceedings mean for Trump's chance of re-election is president of Republicans Overseas, Greg Swenson. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, Sonia. Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Welcome to your first time on today's News Talk. Absolutely wonderful to have you with us. Now, obviously, really interesting what's going on there. I watched it all with great excitement. And is it really possible for Trump to receive a fair trial?
Not really. Not in New York City or in Manhattan specifically. That's going to be tough. 88% of the jury pool are Biden voters and or probably rabid Biden voters or Democrat voters anyway. So I think it's going to be a bit tricky. You know, they'll get through it, but it's going to take some time. And you know, so far they haven't had much luck. And at least I guess the jurors are honest about it.
It's a really difficult process, isn't it? I was listening to jury selection and they were saying things like, well, you know, if the trial lawyer doesn't even like the look of someone, they'll just get bumped. Or if they have, you know, a psychological inkling there's something wrong with them, they'll get bumped. So it's a difficult process. It's not easy, for sure.
Yeah.
But it is obviously problematic. Now, do you think that these criminal proceedings are justified, Greg?
Absolutely not. And I'm not necessarily a huge, you know, supporter of Trump. I was actually behind Ron DeSantis for the nomination process. But I think you even have Democrats and opponents of President Trump, like Alan Dershowitz, for example, you know, that see this as a real weaponization of the justice system. In many ways, it's the ultimate election interference. You know, they've obviously, you know, using lawfare to jail or prosecute a political opponent. You know, that's just not something you'd expect to see in America. But also, you know, look, they've used the courts to try to remove President Trump from ballots in several states. They've, you know, employed the FBI and the CIA on social media censorship and you know, helping doctor up the Russia collusion hoax. You know, even the Democrats themselves have, you know, kept Biden's opponents off the ballot in North Carolina and Florida. They want to pack the court, you know. They'll do anything that isn't necessarily democratic or constitutional, whether it's, you know, in opposition to President Trump or just pushing through executive orders that could never pass through the Congress and go out around the Congress against the Constitution on many things. You know, for example, the student loan relief for canceling student loan obligations, which has already been turned down by the Supreme Court, and Biden's going ahead and doing it anyway. So this is not just the only instance of using the system against a political opponent.
And he is the only opponent who's been used in such a way, right? And which in itself, I think, is fairly shocking. But of course, Trump in court is big box office for many people, isn't it?
It sure is. Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, on one hand, they're keeping him off the campaign trail, which again is, you know, election interference. But on the other hand, he's turned it into a campaign opportunity, like he does most of these things. So it's probably helping him in the near term anyway, with his polling numbers.
Well, that's what I wonder, Greg. Do you think that this will actually in any way derail his presidential hopes?
It, you know, it could if there's convictions and the polling on this is difficult because it's so unprecedented. It's never happened. So no one really can anticipate, you know, how voters will react. But so far with the indictments, they've done nothing but help him. You know, he was virtually tied with Ron DeSantis a year ago before the Alvin Bragg indictment. And then once that was announced, you know, he went up 15 points. Most of that came from DeSantis. So it was a 30-point swing. So it's obviously helped him hugely in the nomination process. Perhaps the Democrats wanted that because they wanted Trump to be the opponent. So then the question is, does it help him in the general? So far, I think it has, or if anything, it hasn't hurt him. That's for sure. But the big mystery is, if there's a conviction, which there very well could be because of the jury pool, then what does that do to his numbers? And that's the, you know, it could hurt him. And some of the polling is indicating that people are behind him right now. People think this is weaponization of the justice system or a witch hunt or whatever you want to call it. And there's such great merit to that argument. It's hard to dispute that. But if there's a conviction, that could change the sentiment. It doesn't have to change everybody's mind. All it has to do is change 5% of the voters.
I mean, in the event of a conviction, what would be the likely outcome? Because I was listening to people yesterday commenting on this, and they said it's highly unlikely that he would get a custodial sentence. What are your thoughts on that?
I think so, but nothing would surprise me with the Democrats. I mean, look what they've done so far. You know, the Alvin Bragg ran on his campaign for election. He ran on getting Trump, you know, the so-called Get Trump campaign slogan, which, you know, so did Letitia James, so have several of these prosecutors. So, you know, nothing would surprise me. But on the other hand, you know, it would be a real stretch. I think it would be just, you know, a real dangerous move for the Dems to do this, given, you know, the potential repercussions, the potential payback when there's Republicans in charge. But I think more importantly, Sonia, this thing will get overturned on appeal. You know, the only reason he could potentially get a conviction is not because there's any legal merit to this case, which there's not. The way that they can get a conviction is just convince a very hostile jury pool or hostile 12 jurors to convict. I don't think that's a stretch, given how much they dislike, you know, Trump derangement syndrome is so alive and well in New York City, in Manhattan specifically. If this trial was in Staten Island, I think he'd be acquitted tomorrow morning. So the real issue is, you know, okay, you know, he could get a conviction, but it will easily be overturned in an appeals court.
What are the next steps from here on in, Greg?
So I think the next few days is jury selection. I think what we saw yesterday, the difficulty of that means it might take longer than expected. So maybe that stretches into early next week. And then, you know, you're looking at maybe 8 weeks. I think the experts have indicated, you know, 6 to 8 weeks total. My guess is it goes towards, closer to 8 weeks just because of this jury selection challenge. And there'll be other hiccups for sure. And I think you'll see some, let's say, unfiltered commentary from President Trump. And that's probably going to create some headaches for his defense team, but also for the judge.
He's pretty much uncontrollable, isn't he? He's going to do and say whatever he wants to, right?
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, one of the reasons that he was elected in 2016.
Right.
People thought that was refreshing, the unfiltered, you know, sort of honesty of him. You know, for someone who his opponents always claim he's lying all the time, he's actually deliberately honest, and he says the things that people are thinking. And, you know, he says some things that you know, most polite Americans would probably suggest you shouldn't say, but he says them anyway. And that's, again, that's refreshing, but sometimes gets him into trouble.
I think that's, people like that authenticity, though, don't they? I think we're all really sick of presidents being like, you know, PR, really. What do you think Biden is currently thinking?
I'm not sure he's thinking, but he's going through a rough patch himself. I mean, you know, I think this might help him in the sense that, you know, if he stays out of the fray and sort of stays above it, he'll look presidential and maybe even create a facade that he has nothing to do with this, which is not true. But he might want to run with that. Clearly, none of these indictments would happen without the blessing or encouragement of Biden and his administration. They put real pressure on Alvin Bragg to do this. So, but I think, it, you know, in the near term, the president will look, you know, President Biden will look, you know, above the fray. So that's probably good for him. But, you know, this is just another example. And I've listed a few already, you know, just the shamelessness of what they'll do to maintain power. It's really worrisome. And they talk about, you know, quote unquote democracy, and Trump is a threat to democracy, and he's going to be a dictator. If you look at, you know, who really has the risk, and RFK Jr. just said this over the weekend. You know, if you look at the two men, Biden is much more likely to be, you know, to threaten the Constitution. He already has. And so I think that, you know, that sort of reality is becoming more apparent to voters. And, it, you know, again, with the student loan relief is the most recent example of it. That was only a week ago. But he's really shameless. So, you know, this is going to be the election of who do you dislike less, as opposed to who do you really love? They're both deeply unpopular as far as presidents go historically.
Indeed.
The advantage that Trump has is, you know, his approval disapproval is minus 10, but Biden's is minus 20. He's the least popular president of all time. The only one polling worse than him right now is Vice President Kamala Harris, who you're essentially voting for if you vote for Biden.
Right. Got you. Listen, Greg, we greatly appreciate you joining us this morning. Please come back. Keep us up to speed with what's going on in the trial. Love your look, your insight into this. Everybody, this is Greg Swenson, Chairman, Republicans Overseas. Take good care of yourself. We'll go to the news headlines and be right back.
Turn on the news.
I have a little news flash.
TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for a maximum restraint amidst escalating tensions in the Middle East, warning that the region is on the brink of a full-scale war following Iran's drone and missile strike on Israel. Former President Donald Trump's legal team has requested a postponement of his Florida classified documents case due to his commitment to a separate trial in New York, where he's accused of falsifying business records during the 2016 presidential campaign.
Whatever happened to good? It's a word that gets thrown around a lot, and it's become our automatic answer to so much.
Hey, how's things?
Good.
Your mom, your weekend?
Good, good. Is good even that good anymore? At the Selbos, we believe good deserves better. Let's reclaim its true meaning. To us, good has always been about making a difference, and good never picks or chooses who it helps. Isn't it time we all remember what good really means?
Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome. Prediabetes does. One in three adults has prediabetes, but with early diagnosis, prediabetes can be reversed. And you can change the outcome. Take the 1 minute prediabetes risk test today. Go to doihaveprediabetes.org.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
And welcome back. Now, the government hopes its plans to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda will become law by the end of the week, but it still faces further scrutiny in the House of Lords later today. There's even been talk about widening the scheme to include other places such as Costa Rica and Armenia. But will the Rwanda scheme ever get off the ground? To tell us his thoughts, I'm joined by former UKIP leader Henry Bolton. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Henry, what is going on? Do you think these plans will ever come to fruition?
Probably okay.
Clearly, Henry is highly amused by that question, right?
Yeah, I mean, in some form, we're going to see something happen. And I mean, because one of the other things that we've seen in the mix, it didn't really get very much attention, is that a scheme that already exists to encourage people who have failed the asylum process in the UK to leave, and which involves paying them £3,000, has been extended to this as well. So the point being that there will be some people, I'm sure, out of the asylum seekers sort of population here in the UK, that say, okay, yeah, I'll take $3,000 to go to Rwanda because it's been extended to the Rwanda thing. So they volunteer. And the point here is that in volunteering, then there is no resistance, there's no appeal from their side to being sent to Rwanda. So we will probably see at least one flight going to Rwanda. And the Prime Minister undoubtedly will say, look, a flight has taken off to Rwanda. What a success. What a victory. This government is delivering. But it's not. Because ultimately, what the British people have been told is that all this Rwanda thing, all this time in Parliament, all the expense, and all the sort of bandwidth of government, the Foreign Office, Home Office, and so on, taken up with this, is to stop the boats. So if that truly is the plan, and that is the aim of the plan, to stop the boats, it will fail. It will fail massively. It will not stop the boats. And in fact, despite all of this sort of looming, we've had 748 people cross the English Channel from France this weekend. So there's no deterrence at the moment. Figures are going up. The numbers are going up. They're not going down. And, you know, having worked this, you introduced me as the former UKIP leader. Indeed, I am. But for some years, I led the UK's efforts to disrupt transnational people smuggling through southeastern and eastern Europe, and that was in 2003 to 2006. And I can tell you that, you know, the people smugglers are very effective at marketing what they're doing, very effective at encouraging people, sort of recruiting people, economic migrants, into the people smuggling networks. And by the time they get to the North French coast, it is too late. They've not really got a way back. Their whole sort of the last few months or so of their lives has been orientated towards getting to the UK. They're not going to turn around just because we send about 1 in 80 to Rwanda.
Right, right.
The government's idea that this is a deterrent is utterly and totally flawed. The question I can't answer is whether that's deliberately flawed or not.
Well, it was sort of leading me there, Henry. But so what you're really saying is this is all smoke and mirrors. The fact is only 1% is ever likely to be sent to Rwanda, which leaves 99%. It's not a deterrent. We know for a fact that there are actually Rwandans who are seeking asylum as they are debating this at this moment in time. So that doesn't make any sense in its own right? At least 3,500 people have crossed in small boats this year alone. So again, not a deterrent. So what is the alternative?
Well, I'm going to slightly correct you. I think we're heading already for 5,000.
I took that figure from a minister in Parliament yesterday. So even Parliament haven't got their figures correctly.
The alternative... Well, just to add a sort of more sort of fairly recent news... We're spending, I think it's $4.3 billion from the international aid budget on making these asylum seekers feel welcome and comfortable in the UK. And now that's my wording, it's not the government's wording, but accommodating them in hotels and so on. That's in addition to the figures we've already had. So we are spending a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of effort deciding what to do once they get to the UK. That's the wrong focus. It needs to be dealt with, true, but the focus needs to be on stopping them getting here in the first place. Reducing the flow. And that means there's a key piece to this, but which I'll come to, but it means utilizing our foreign aid budget, our diplomatic effort, our intelligence effort, our military effort, all sorts of different elements of government being used to address the push factors. Why is it that somebody leaves Sudan or Eritrea or whatever and starts heading towards the UK? What encourages them to do it? What are the conditions? How do we address that? So that's one filter, if you like, if we can address that partially. We will never address all of those push factors totally. How do we engage with the governments there to make sure that the environment, the living, the social, economic environment and so on is appropriate? Because a little point on there, in Africa, the United Nations Population Fund says that the African population is going to have doubled by 2050. Africa can't support that size population at the moment. How are we going to address that? Because the extra sort of 1.5 billion people or so are going to head not to China, not to the United States, not to Australia or so. They are going to head towards Europe. We need to get ahead of that game. And the only way is that push factor.
It all feels very circular, though, Henry. It feels like we've been here before. This is like hump day over and over and over again. And so one of the things that troubles me is, what is our role in this? And I will use one example. So one of the ministers yesterday during the reading of this was talking about the sheer volume of Afghan men who were coming over in the small boats. And they were saying that part of that problem was these men and these families had put their trust into the intervention of the US and the UK in Afghanistan. And then when they left all these people at the whim of the Taliban. So don't we have a responsibility here somewhere? No. I mean, not least, presumably not to be getting ourselves involved in other people's businesses.
Not in that sense. We tried to help the Afghans. I was part of that effort for 27 months in Helmand. I led the stabilization teams in Northern Helmand for that nearly 2.5 years. We presented the Afghan population with an offer, an alternative. Now, I would dispute that that was the right policy, but that's what we did. They decided not to take it as a society. As a society, they were resisting that all the way through. And I had interpreters, two of whom were involved in passing intelligence to the Taliban. Not all interpreters working for the international community were good guys. But then think about the context. It's very easy for politicians sitting in parliament or activists or anybody else to say, oh, yes, but this all started because of what we did in Afghanistan and we've got a responsibility. Actually, no. 20, 25 years ago, before Afghanistan, the Afghans were highly organized in smuggling economic migrants out of Afghanistan through Central Asia into the Russian Federation. They then sort of had a staging post, which was something called the Sevastopol Rynok. The Sevastopol Market was the name of it. It's south, just south of Moscow. It was an entire sort of area of transiting Afghans heading towards Europe and the European Union. So that's been long established. The point here is that my second filter, if you like, is how do we address the organized criminals who are doing the marketing and the facilitation of this movement.
Right.
It's been going on for many years. So there's the push factors, there's the organized crime, the networks, and we need to hunt them down. And I mean hunt them down ruthlessly. Community policing doesn't have a part to play in this. This is about hardened, evil people who are probably responsible for more deaths than terrorists.
Yeah. Great deal of people trafficking going on there. And I think that's a really important element of this story that we need to also examine, because it's very easy for us to become very dewy-eyed about this situation without actually looking at the whole picture. Listen, Henry, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Really important insight there. I wasn't actually aware entirely of your history and the negotiations that you had been involved in, but that is absolutely interesting. Everybody, this is Henry Bolton, and he is here today with us on today's news. Talk. We'll be right back.
I'm Naheem Hines, professional football player and proud supporter of the Muscular Dystrophy Association. My mom was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy when I was 14, and I watched her struggle. But MDA helped her get the best treatments and care, and they also help kids like my buddy Ethan.
My name is Ethan, and I'm 12 years old. Thanks to the Muscular Dystrophy Association and people like you, I have more hope than ever before. From day one, they've treated me like family at my local care center. MDA is the only one that funds over 150 care centers across the U.S. to help provide state-of-the-art care for adults and kids like me.
For over 70 years, MDA has been transforming the lives of people living with muscular dystrophy, ALS, and other related neuromuscular diseases. They fund the research for breakthrough treatments, care, and cures. And MDA provides support to thousands of families like mine and Ethan's in communities like yours. Thanks to MDA, kids and adults can live life to its fullest. Join us and learn more at MDA.org today.
Hi, I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you out, because only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, Assistant Smokey Bear, call me Papa Bear, because I'm grilling up dinner. Do you get it?
Yes, good job.
So, what should I do with all these coals?
Don't just toss them out. Put them in a metal container, because those embers can start a wildfire.
I understand. The stakes
are high.
Ha, 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 ha.
See, Smokey thinks I'm funny.
You're with Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk, TNT.
That was an interesting insight. Henry was just telling me off camera some of the other points that he would like to raise in the future coming forward. And I said, absolutely, come back and we'll have that conversation and widen it out. Now, I am delighted to be joined by Chloe Dobbs. She's a political commentator, contributor to Reason UK and multitude of media. Good morning to you, Chloe. Lovely to have you with us
here. Morning, Sonia. Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Now, you have got a bit of a hot potato story to discuss with me. So obviously, not just Rishi Sunak facing all the political flak in the UK at the moment. We have Labour leader Keir Starmer. He's in very serious trouble right over the backing of his deputy, Angela Rayner, despite the fact that she may have broken electoral law. She says she'll resign if she's found guilty of having done that. And the matter is now in the hands of the Greater Manchester Police. So, Chloe, for the benefit of many listeners around the globe, remind us how this story came to be.
So what's happened is Angela Rayner benefited from the right to buy scheme, which she wants to be demolished. She was able to buy her council house at a discount for 79 grand, and she sold it now for around 125 grand and made herself a nice, cosy profit from that. Now, she had two homes. So she was newly married with small children, and claims that she was living at a different house to her husband and those children, making Vicarage Road, the house in question, her primary address in theory. Now, that means that she was able to avoid capital gains tax, which is where the row comes from. Now, we're only talking about probably about 1,500 quid here that she would have saved. But what she's really guilty of, if she has lied about this, is hypocrisy. Because time and time again, she has told Tories that they must resign if they have been, say, for example, with Boris Johnson, as soon as he not even was found guilty, but put under investigation for the Partygate scandal, she said he's not fit for office, he needs to resign. So that's why the Tories are piling as much as they can on Rayner because of this, because it makes her look like such a hypocrite.
Yeah, and rightfully so. She is, isn't she? She's famous for her virtue signalling all across the board on all manner of issues. So I think I don't blame them, actually, on this occasion. How's Labour reacting to all this? What is their support for her?
This is quite a sticky situation for Labour because Angela Rayner is actually very popular with a lot of grassroots of the party and a lot of young people in the party. She is the only person in the shadow cabinet who is directly elected by the members, which makes it particularly difficult for them to get rid of her. But this seems to be a scandal that keeps on rumbling on. And so I guess there is this worry that this could damage Labour. I think that one thing that it does to damage Labour is it kind of destroys this faux pas of them having being, you know, this sort of morally perfect party that has the moral high ground. You know, they're showing themselves to be the same hypocrites and the same liars as they always claim that the Tories are. So it is very difficult for Keir Starmer. I think that he will avoid getting rid of her unless he has to, because, as I said, he really needs her when she's especially the only person directly elected by the members in that shadow cabinet and is very popular. But if she is found guilty, I think she will have to go. I think that her coming out and saying, I will resign if I am found guilty, does two things. It tries to stop the attacks of her being a hypocrite if she says, I will follow the same principles as I have claimed to follow before. But it also, you know, it might be a bit of a bluff trying to make the Tories go away, you know, stop trying to get this investigated, because by making herself sound confident that she is innocent and they're not going to find anything. I think that she is guilty. I think it's absolute rubbish to suggest that when you're newly married with kids, you're living in a separate house to your husband. Not that that's impossible, but I think it's pretty unlikely.
Yeah. She's playing fast and loose, isn't she? Obviously, she's doubled down. And the thing is, you're talking about how she is popular, but she's also divisive, isn't she?
Oh, absolutely. And for many, many years, she has gone on the attack on Conservatives, as I've said, you know, insisting that they release their tax returns, that Boris resigned straight away after he was put under investigation, you know, before he was even found guilty of anything. He's not fit for office. He must resign. You know, is this sort of divisive, shouty attitude, which I really don't like, which I don't think is productive in politics at all. So the Tories are going to try and make this story run as long as they can, because it is exposing Angela Rayner and the Labour Party as a whole for who they really are. We'll see how long it lasts. That will be partly, you know, depends how long the police take to investigate and what the result of that investigation is. The Labour Party keep trying to make this issue go away. They did that by trying to keep the limelight on the Lee Anderson scandal for as long as possible, but then the Lee Anderson scandal disappeared and this came back up. I think Angela Rayner's definitely got herself in quite a bind by talking about, you know, she tried to make herself sound innocent by saying, I've been given tax advice, which says that I did the right thing. And then we say, okay, well, show us the tax advice then. And suddenly she doesn't want to show it to us, which sounds a bit fishy to me. If the advice clearly shows you to be innocent, why wouldn't you just release it and end this as quickly as possible? So sounds dodgy to me. And then you've got Keir Starmer. You've got people backing her, making excuses for her. Keir Starmer saying, no, I don't want to look at the advice, even though I'm a trained lawyer and I could probably have a look at it and tell her what I think of it. I don't want to look at it because I think she's innocent and that'd be wrong to do so. You've then got David Lammy defending her. You've got people saying, oh, she's not the PM, so it doesn't make her a hypocrite having said what she said to Boris Johnson. It's just silly excuses coming out here, there and everywhere from everyone.
I think it's really interesting because obviously she comes from a very working class background, as indeed do I. And one of the things that she said before is that that shoutiness that she has, that is part of her working class background, that she obviously can be very crude. She says some pretty horrendous things about the opposite party, but she seems to want to play both sides, Chloe. And that is, she draws on that working class background of hers, but on the same level, she's actually behaving in a way which is very much part of sort of elite hierarchical behavior. So it's like, it's almost like she's caught between two stools. Do you think that she's forgotten her roots?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, actually, and that she tries to dismiss her behavior on the basis that she's working class. And, you know, I think that the Lee Anderson saga did show that people in Parliament, you know, in the ivory tower, as you might say, speak differently to your everyday individual. Lee Anderson speaks like your typical person in a pub would speak, but apparently that's cancelable if a politician speaks like that. So there is an element of that, but I do think that she is much shoutier, much more abrasive than, you say, being working class necessarily exposes. And the fact that she, as you say, has engaged in all of this bickering and calling for people to resign here, there and everywhere, that does seem like the games of Westminster. It doesn't make her look separate to them in any way. I think what will be interesting is if she is found guilty, how will she spin it? Because what she might say is, I'm a normal working class woman, not from a fancy background. I was negligent of the tax laws. Whereas Nadeem Zahawi, you know, he was in a huge position, making tons of money with expert accountants. That's a different situation. You can't compare the two of them. So she might excuse herself. So she might try and use this working class card to excuse herself if she is found guilty. So we'll see what happens.
Oh, working class people are many things, but we're not automatically criminals, right? So, and it's very serious that she's facing a criminal investigation and a potential criminal charge. What does this actually say about Keir Starmer's judgment, do you think, Chloe?
I think that Keir Starmer is, you know, he's used, if you say his judgment, he's perhaps used his judgment well by putting a very popular woman into such a high position. And understandably, you know, maybe he would not have foreseen this. This has come out of the blue. You wouldn't expect him to have known about this specific issue when he promoted her. But nevertheless, I think Keir Starmer is in a very difficult position. And you're seeing this is just one example of many things where he's trying to hold a party together, that he's trying to pretend is united, but is not really united. We've really seen this with the Israel-Palestine stuff, and especially that Rochdale election with Azhar Ali. That's just another example of his party sort of falling apart and not being completely united. They got rid of Azhar Ali, but then you had other Labour members and Labour councillors still going out and campaigning for him. You've had absolute disarray over the Gaza situation in the cabinet and across the party. So he's dealing with a lot of mess in the party, but nevertheless, his lead in the polls is so great that even if this does cause a bit of a sting, it's not like he's going to lose the general election, is it?
So that sounds like you're pretty convinced he's going to win the general election, Chloe. Is that where your money is?
Oh, absolutely. The question is just how big of a majority. So the polls suggest it's going to be, you know, a complete Tory wipeout or close to it. Now, I don't think that the polls will reflect what happens on election day exactly. You always have a little bit of pushback where you have people who say they're going to switch to vote Labour, but then it comes to the ballot box and they get scared and they err on the side of caution and they vote Conservative. And then you've also got, clearly in the polls, we are seeing a huge surge in support for the Reform Party. And I think that they will get a lot of votes. But again, you will have people who get to the ballot box and err on the side of caution. Also, it can be to do with local candidates. So Reform are trying to stand a candidate in every single seat across the country. And as a brand new party, that is quite hard to field enough people who are high quality to do that. So I think that you will have some seats where people initially have said, I'm going to vote Reform on the looking at the national picture. And then they look at the local candidates in front of them and they say, I don't think this person's up to the job. And then they end up voting Labour or Conservative. But nevertheless, I do think that Labour are going to get a pretty big majority at this election. That being said, you know, we've probably got, 6 months, something like that, before the election. And you know what they say, a week is a long time in politics.
Oh, yes, a day is.
you never know what sort of huge scandal could erupt that right. Could completely change the picture. What I will say about this scandal is I think that there is often a misconception in the Westminster bubble, as we may call it, that some of these nitpicky scandals mean a lot more to the electorate than they actually do.
Good point.
Lot of the time, stuff about tax affairs, everyone in Westminster is talking about it, but then you look at actual voters and they just care about, can I pay my bills? Can I put food on the table for my family? And that right. sort of thing. People who aren't super involved in politics, but thinking about who they're going to vote, they think about things that actually affect them. I think that Partygate was an exception to that because everybody was really affected by lockdown laws and almost everyone had some sort of horrendous situation like, one of my close family members died and I wasn't able to attend their funeral or say goodbye to them. And to see that, Boris was, partying in number 10. That really annoyed the public. So that scandal, I say, was an exception. But on the whole, things like tax affairs scandals, this might just all be hot air in Westminster, but doesn't really make much difference in the polls. But the Tories, they're going to use whatever arsenal they can find. So they're just, throwing whatever they can at the wall and see what sticks. And they're going to try and make this Angela Rayner scandal go on for as long as they possibly can.
Got you. Absolutely. They'll use it, won't they? They'll use it. Just before you leave us, Chloe, we have a question of the day. We're asking a question in relation to what's going on in Parliament to do with the smoking and vaping bill that's going through. What are your thoughts? Do you think that a cigarette ban is a problem for our civil liberties, or do you not have any really thoughts about that?
You know what? I'm actually quite conflicted about this. I think that in the past, I've been very much sort of a libertarian who's in favour of decriminalising drugs and just treating drug users as someone who has a mental health issue that needs help as opposed to someone who is criminal. And that's the view I've taken in the past for many years. But now I'm looking at what is happening, for example, on the streets of San Francisco and other places where they're having horrendous drug epidemics. And I'm thinking, it is my theory about drugs needing to be legalized is maybe that wrong. I think one thing that I do have a big issue with the smoking ban is it seems a bit arbitrary. So alcohol is everywhere, and that's not going to be banned anytime soon. Why cigarettes?
Both agree with you. Unfortunately, Chloe, it's bringing us to the end of this segment, which is such a pity, but I really appreciate you giving us some feedback. Everybody, this is Chloe Dobbs. She is, of course, as you can tell, an excellent political commentator. We will be right back after the hour. Thank you so much for joining us, Chloe.
Thank you.